from KLW News in San Francisco. This is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City, otherwise known as Little Manila.
Lower Haight.
Outer Richmond.
Fremont.
South of Market.
Coming up, we'll speak with the recently appointed leader of California's Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, Secretary Jeffrey Beard.
Once you take a person out of the community and you put them in prison, you make it much, much more difficult for them to get back out again.
Then we'll hear how Oakland residents are fighting prostitution in their neighborhoods by riding to the Johns cruising their streets.
Dear John, we want to make you aware that this area has had an increase in drug dealings, vehicle theft, robberies, and prostitution.
And we'll drop in on a conversation between mother and daughter about financial independence.
Why do I have to get out your house when I graduate?
To pursue the rest of your education to get your bachelor's degree.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents.
I'm here to announce the prison emergency is over in California.
Today, that's Governor Jerry Brown at a press conference earlier this year declaring the state's prison problem officially fixed. The state is under federal mandate to reduce its prison population and improve medical care for inmates. And the governor says California has spent billions of dollars to hire more staff to ensure that the system has excellent health care. So in January, Brown signed an executive order eliminating the emergency and filed papers to terminate the federal oversight of the mental health system.
This is a very intrusive effort by federal judges to fix and remedy problems in the prison system. But at some point, the job's done.
But is it really done? The state has yet to meet the benchmark set by the court for reducing the prison population to 112,000 inmates. The man who will lead the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation as it navigates these legal questions is Secretary Jeffrey Beard. He spoke with us about how he'll approach his new job.
Well, I guess the first way I approach my work is by getting to know the people and the system and the problems and issues that they face. And I was fortunate in that I had been consulting out here for almost 2 years before I got the job. And so I got to learn a lot about the system and at least some of their bigger problems. I think what I'm still learning is some of the smaller stuff.
And what do you think are the biggest problems with the system?
One of the biggest problems, obviously, is the continuing court oversight in the medical and mental health and in other areas. I think that court oversight had some positive reasons back when it started in the 2000s. And I guess the one court case has been going on for like 17 years. But I think, you know, the CDCR has now reached the point where they're providing what I believe is a constitutional level of care for medical and mental health for the inmates. And in some ways, the continuing court oversight prevents CDCR from moving ahead as well as fast as they would like to move ahead in some things.
How does it prevent you from moving ahead?
Well, like, for instance, in the mental health area, for instance, if you wanted to make a change in your policies or your procedures, you have to go to the special master. You have to get approval from the special master. There has to be an agreement. It could take months to work out a change. The plaintiffs may have to get involved in making the change. So it's that kind of thing that slows down really moving forward.
And one mental health issue in the prisons, the LA Times reports that the suicide rate is climbing in the California prison system. How are you addressing that?
Well, first of all, I don't think the suicide rate is climbing. It's higher than many other states. And the way we're addressing it is to look at each and every suicide that occurs and try to learn from those suicides and learn if there's something different that we should be doing, and also listening to what outside experts tell us that should be being done within the system. And when I frankly look at what California is doing, I think they have a very robust, very in-depth suicide prevention plan, and they're working very hard to bring it down. One of the problems they're going to have is that realignment actually somewhat hurts them, because the people that were left behind are the more violent offenders, the offenders who are serving a longer period of time, and it's precisely that group of individuals who tend to be more likely to commit suicide. So that's one reason why the rate may not be coming down as quickly as we would like it to, but we're going to continue to work on it and bring it down.
And how do you think realignment is going so far, and specifically with regard to one of the unintended consequences of realignment, which is the fact that I've heard a lot of reports that there are fewer programs for the prisoners who are left in the California system?
Well, actually, that's there are not fewer programs. And in fact, that's another area that I'm going to be focusing on, is to continue to increase the programs. And actually, they had already begun to increase the programs out here before I got here. The legislature appropriated a specific pool of money for programs. That money has to be used for that purpose and is being used for that purpose. And we're seeing a resurgence of education programs, vocational training programs, substance abuse programs, and the like.
So can you give me the specifics of where that's increasing?
Throughout the system.
But like where? Because that's not what we're hearing from inmates. We're hearing that there are fewer opportunities.
Well, that's not true. Not within the past year or so, there's been something like 7,500, for instance, 7,500 education slots added to the system within the past year or so, and that continues to be developed. So it may not be moving as fast as the inmates would like, but in fact, there are more programs. And starting, I believe, within the next couple months, we're going to be opening up 13 reentry centers in 13 of our facilities around the state. And those reentry centers will have intensive programming for people who are getting near the end of their sentence. It'll have substance abuse, cognitive behavioral type programs, and also education and vocational training programs. So, you know, things are improving. If you go back maybe 3 or 4 years with the downturn in the economy, programs were shut down. It did go backwards. That's no longer the case. They're moving forward, and they're going to continue to move forward as we go into the next few years. And we're going to also be focusing on programs that make a difference. In other words, we're not going to just spend money to do a program to do a program. We're going to only spend money and our limited resources on those programs that make a difference in terms of reducing recidivism for the inmates. In other words, making them less likely to go out and commit new crimes, less likely to come back to prison in the future.
You mentioned that since you took the job as secretary of the CDCR, you've been talking to people. Who are you talking with? How are you going around and talking with both inmates and guards and all of the constituents that may, and families that make up this system?
Well, before I, you know, was working here, as I said, I was a consultant for a couple years, and I visited over 20 of the institutions. During that time, I had an opportunity to talk to staff and to talk to inmates. And since I've taken the job, I've continued to visit prisons, talk to inmates, talk to staff, and have also met with various groups. I've met with the Sheriff's Association, met with the Chiefs Association, just recently met with a victims group. So I'm starting. And, you know, I've been meeting with, you know, a wide range of people that either are directly or indirectly involved with the prison system.
And Governor Brown says that the work to improve this system is essentially done and the court oversight should end. It was actually some of your testimony that resulted in the federal court order to cap the California prison population. And so you said that you agreed with your testimony back then, but things have changed. How do you think, what do you think has changed?
Well, what I think has changed is a number of things. First of all, the population is down almost 25%. There's 43,000 less inmates than back at the peak. Before California started to change the way they do business. Number two, there's been a significant reduction in receptions coming into the system. Back at the peak, they had 140,000 inmates coming into the system a year. When you get that many people coming into the system, it's very difficult to catch all the mental health and all the medical problems as they come in the front door. Today, we only have 35,000 a year coming into the system, a huge, huge drop. So numbers are down greatly. And the other area that we've seen significant change is they've hired a lot of staff around the state, doctors, nurses, social workers, psychologists. They have more staff today, and they're of higher levels of training than they had back in 2005, 2006. The other thing that has happened is they've constructed facilities inside the institutions so they can provide better medical and mental health care, and they continue to bring those new facilities online. So when you look at it from a staffing standpoint, when you look at it from a construction, when you look at it from just the sheer numbers being dropped, and then when you look at their policies and procedures, where they do a lot of things that are best practice kinds of things, and you put it all together, you now have a system that, again, in my view, is providing a constitutional level of care for both medical and mental health needs.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan, and that's Jeffrey Beard, the new Secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. He's become the leader of the department at a point when it's facing great changes and challenges. The long-term effects of realignment, that's the state's prison population reduction plan, are still uncertain. And Governor Brown is asking for more autonomy from the federal government as the department moves forward with reforms to the prison healthcare system. We'll rejoin my conversation with Secretary Beard as he gives his impression of San Quentin State Prison and why San Quentin's model of providing educational and cultural programs to inmates isn't as common at other prisons.
It's not a matter of us not exporting that model elsewhere. It's more a matter of the local communities in the area where many of the prisons are built don't show the kind of support that we get in that Bay Area. I think CDCR is and always will be open to any community support that we can get. I know that our wardens work within their communities and develop that support and have some levels of the support that you're noting in the Bay Area at San Quentin. It's just that you have more people there that are interested in helping out and in helping the inmates get ready for their return back into the community. And I wish more people around the state would show that same kind of interest in our other prisons, because I think if they did, it would help the inmates feel better about themselves when they go out, because they'd know there's people out there that are willing to help them. And it would really help with that whole reentry process, which can be very difficult for many inmates.
And a lot of people have criticized the California penal system and many of the U.S. prison systems as systems that just were not designed well in the first place and really don't accommodate the idea of rehabilitation, and that people don't realize that these are folks who are coming back into the community every day. So I'm just wondering, if you had a carte blanche to recreate the system, what would be your priorities? What would you do?
Well, I think if I could change things, I would first of all not lock up as many people as we lock up, as we were locking up here in California and as we do around the country. I think it's important that we keep some of the less serious offenders more in the community, where they can perhaps be punished if they need to go to jail for a period of time, but also get the kinds of programming that they need at that community level. Once you take a person out of the community and you put them in prison, you make it much, much more difficult for them to get back out again. And they also tend to associate with more serious offenders when you do that. So if I were starting over, I would make sure that we limit our prisons to those serious violent offenders that are very dangerous to protect our society, and those less serious people I would not send into our prison systems. Because you're right, what's going to happen is that, you know, 90% of the people basically are coming back someday. And if we put too many of them in the prison system, as I think we have done around the country over the years, we make their reentry much more difficult, and we make it much more likely they're going to fail and end up committing new crimes and having new victims. So I think that that's one of the biggest things we could do. And the other thing is that I would look at some of the systemic drivers to incarceration in the first place. You know, we know that many of our inmates come from a few poor inner cities where they have poor schools in many cases. And we know that 70% of the inmates who come in the system have a substance abuse problem that was not dealt with and addressed in the community. They couldn't get the treatment they needed. And we know about 20% of them have a mental health problem. If we did a better job with our schools, if we provided more opportunity in our inner cities, if we did a better job providing substance abuse, if we did a better job dealing with the mentally ill, we would have less people coming to prison in the first place.
I also wonder about determinant sentencing and the fact that there is no requirement to do any kind of rehab or education program in California's prisons. Do you think that's something that we should rethink?
Well, I don't know that you have to rethink determinant sentencing. I do think, however, there needs to be some incentive for inmates to become involved in programs. And I think where you have an incentive, whatever that might be, and you could have it with determinant sentencing by letting them have some credit and some time off. And I know in the California system, there are credits that are given for certain program participations. You know, certainly that kind of thing makes it more likely that inmates will become involved and in the first place, and then be less likely to come back to prison if they complete those programs.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about that I've heard from a lot of inmates is that there's this kind of culture between the guards and the prisoners of seeing inmates as subhuman, and that this can lead to abuse and certainly bad relations. Do you think that that's an issue?
I have not noted that to be an issue in having visited some 27 institutions up to this point. And I know that there's a very detailed system in place to look for any kind of staff misconduct, any kind of abuse. That is not tolerated in this system. And so I think that while there may be some inmates who don't get along with some staff in general, from what I've seen when I've gone around, there seems to be a good relationship between the staff and the inmates in most cases, and I'm not aware of any widespread abuse or that that's an issue.
What do you hope to accomplish as secretary? What would you like people to say about your tenure when you're done with this job?
Well, I think there's three main things. The first thing is, you know, you can always make prisons safer, so I would like to see the prisons be safer for staff and for inmates. Number two, I would like to get the programs back in place and make sure that they're programs that make a difference, programs that will make people less likely to come back to prison. I think that's really one of our public safety responsibilities to do that. And third, I'd like to see the court oversight lifted from the state, and I would like to see the system be turned back so that we can operate both the medical and the mental health areas. I think if I could accomplish things in those three areas, I would feel that I've done something.
Jeffrey Beard is the new secretary of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. You can let us know what you think the secretary should tackle in his new job. Just leave us a message at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Again, just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your comments on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. In Oakland, there are certain neighborhoods where crime happens literally before your very eyes. If you drive down San Pablo Boulevard or International Boulevard, you'll often see young women or girls standing on corners, scantily clad, and leaning into cars. Street prostitution is a visible and major problem in Oakland, but arrest rates have dropped by 37% in the past 2 years. It's unclear why that's the case, but residents aren't waiting for law enforcement to pick up the slack. Instead, residents of the San Antonio neighborhood, which includes some of the main trafficking corridors, have launched what's called the Dear John campaign. It's meant to take on the street-level sex trafficking that happens right outside their front doors. Reporter Laura Flynn went to a recent community meeting to learn more about this strategy.
Dear John, a vehicle registered under your name, license number S, has been observed in the area of 1800 block of International Boulevard in Oakland on January 14th. We want to make you aware that this area has had an increase in drug dealings, vehicle theft, robberies, and prostitution.
This is a Dear John letter. To get one, you have to take your car to Oakland's San Antonio neighborhood and linger. You have to arouse suspicion that you're propositioning women for sex.
Prostitution is not a victimless crime and is associated with kidnapping, human trafficking, and the sexual exploitation of children.
One of the things that we came up with through our research was this idea to reduce the demand for prostitution by sort of going after the customers.
Andy Nelson is a deputy director of the East Bay Asian Youth Center, or EBACI. They're working with the Oakland Police Department to send these letters to the men who are doing that suspicious lingering, the Johns. On a weekday night, about 6 months after the campaign's launch, Police Captain Johnny Davis stands in front of a crowd of about 50 people, holding a green form.
This is the Dear John report form. This is the form that we use to make a report when we see men trying to buy sex on the corner.
Residents are supposed to write down the vehicle make and model, license plate number, and any other detail they can catch.
And after you fill it out, you mail it to me at the police department. And me or a member of my staff will check the license plate number to make sure it's right, and we get the address.
Since the program launched last July, Davis says he sent out 18 letters. There were 12 more he couldn't send because the reports were illegible. If you count those, that averages out to about a letter a week.
Some of those letters went to businesses like an extermination company. One letter belonged to a garbage truck that originated in West Oakland. One belonged to an electrical company.
Captain Davis says that in the majority of the reports, the vehicles weren't local.
Some of the cities where these cars come from, or these men come from, are San Leandro, Brentwood, San Carlos, San Francisco.
Davis says the goal of the program is to let Johns know that their actions have consequences and that people are watching, even though the letters are anonymous.
They mail the letter to us, and we mail it out under the City of Oakland's letterhead. So the perpetrator or the John, if you will, has no idea who saw them or why this letter's coming to them until they read it.
Usually, though, that's the end of police involvement. Unless they catch a John in the act, there's nothing else they can do.
I love it. We send in the letter to the register owners and hoping that the other half opens it and finds out what their loved ones is doing.
Juan Borquez lives in the neighborhood and manages an apartment building there. As a property manager, he says he's received a flood of complaints from people who live in the building.
Prostitution, especially in front of my apartment, right in front of my windows, disturbing the peace, being loud, obnoxious. And that happened for almost 3 months in a row.
The San Antonio neighborhood is absolutely known in the city as a hot spot, specifically certain areas of International Boulevard. That's really kind of the main track, as it's called, in Oakland. It's known specifically for minors.
Tashina Manioc is a program coordinator at MISSI, an organization working with commercially sexually exploited children. She says a big part of Oakland's prostitution problem relates to young women. In 2009, Los Angeles arrested 69 minors for prostitution. Oakland, which is 12 times smaller, made 75 arrests.
We're really looking at just this massive, like, epidemic of kids that are, again, you know, anywhere from the age to like 11 to probably up to like 16, 17 years old.
Andy Nelson from UBASE says it's too soon to tell if the Dear John program is helping to combat that epidemic, but he's hopeful.
If the Johns feel less comfortable in engaging in the activities that they're engaging in, you know, you can actually make an impact that way.
The Johns are taking note. On MyRedBook.com, a website for people looking for commercial sex, a user recently posted an alert about the program and spurred a long discussion. One person wrote,
"When it's in a residential neighborhood and cars keep driving back and forth around the block, it really sucks for the people that live there. Once a spot gets hot, the cars just don't stop."
That person wrote that he was sure his own license plate had been noted. Others discussed ways to subvert the program.
"It is a very good idea for those of us who cruise to change our registration address to a personal P.O. box or our office's address. I did, and now breathe very comfortably knowing that they can send what the hell they want and it is not coming to my house."
It's hard to confront Johns anonymously, whether on the street or online. But there is one program that talks with them face to face. The SAGE Project in San Francisco runs what's called the John School. Every other month, about 30 Johns meet to learn about how their actions can affect a community. Executive Director Ellen Bell says the goal is to educate the men about the negative consequences of soliciting sex.
Essentially, what we try to do is give awareness, give a kernel of awareness, or plant a seed so that people can begin to examine their own behavior and look at the effects of their behavior upon others, and maybe, just maybe, question their choices in the future.
Project SAGE has been effective at reducing John's recidivism, but the program is for first-time offenders. In other words, people who have gotten caught. It doesn't reach men who've never been arrested. That's a very different approach than the law takes to young women on the street. Again, Missy's Tashina Manyuk.
It's very difficult to arrest Johns because you literally need to catch them in the act. Yet you don't have to catch the girls in the act.
This is what's frustrating for police and community members. Everyone knows the problem is there, but there's only so much they can legally do. Back at the community meeting, residents want to know what their other options are.
Okay, what happens after the letter is sent?
Andy Nelson says sending letters is just one tactic among many.
We worked with the city attorney to get a couple of motels closed down that were real problems on this. We've done things like visibility campaigns. We've had moms from the neighborhood on billboards, you know, warning Johns away from the area. We've worked to get a lot of security cameras up in this neighborhood. We've had a lot of neighborhood walks and marches to draw visibility to the program. We've had the police conducting sweeps. We've been working with the school district for them to educate their staff about what to do to prevent and intervene with girls who are at risk for getting caught up in this. So we've done a whole host of things to address this problem, and we know it's going to take that. It's going to take a lot of everybody working at it from different angles.
More than 40 cities across the U.S. send Dear John letters. Some cities go further, trying tactics like publishing John's names and photos in local newspapers. As for Oakland, community members are eager to get more eyes on the street and more letters in the mail. In Oakland, this is Laura Flynn for Cross Currents.
What do you think about the Dear John campaign? You can let us know at our Facebook page, we're KALW, or you can leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your comments on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. And now it's time for our Money Diary series, which is stories from young people in Oakland talking about their relationships with money. Today we're going to meet Lakeiva Brown. In the fall when she recorded this, Lakeiva was 19 years old, going to Heald College and living in a little apartment in the back of her parents' house. We meet her as she's headed home for the day. Her dad is watching a football game in the living room, and her mom's doing the laundry.
It is 6:24. I'm walking in my house. I just came back from a job interview. Hopefully they call me back. I had a job interview at Berkeley at Adidas store. I'm really excited about it. I really, really, really want that job. Although it's kind of out of the way, I want that job. And then I have another interview tomorrow. I need someone to call me. I'm kind of broke. But I just found out today that I have some plans this weekend, but no money. I come from a home where my mom and dad never hands over money. You have to work for your money. And it's been like that ever since I can walk and wanted to go places by myself. I never could get anything free. I'm fortunate enough, my rent basically is to go to school and maintain passing grades. But I'm on the honor roll, so that's why they're a little bit leaner with me. My mom is sort of like always busy, so you know how that is. She's a very hardworking woman. She's not even a single parent. I grew up in a house with both of my parents. Like, me being African American, that's kind of a big deal. And I live in a stable home. My parents are not on drugs or anything. Okay, so mom, she's trying to fix the dryer. Okay, so, you know, I'm 19, I'm about to be 20 next year. What's the difference between now that I'm 19 and when you were 19? What were you doing different?
I was working and going to school and just having fun.
Oh, okay. So when are big responsibilities come up when it came to involving having money? When did it become a necessity?
When I was purchasing my home, I knew that was a big factor.
Okay, so when will, like, you know, you told me when I graduate from my college, Hill College, you said I have to get out your house. Why do I have to get out your house when I graduate?
To pursue the rest of your education to get your bachelor's degree.
Okay, well, when I get my bachelor's, I feel like I should be able to stay here.
Well, no, I don't think you should stay here because you have to grow up. I'm not going to live forever. I want to die at peace knowing that you can stand on your own two feet.
Okay.
That piece was produced by Lisa Morehouse and Game Theory Academy, a financial education program for young adults. You can find out more about them at kalw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our stories, post comments, and send us feedback. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. Today's team includes Isabel Angel, Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Maya DePaula Haneke, Nina Gensler-Debs, Alyssa Kapnick, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Erica Moo, Sarah Reynolds, Laura Sapinara, Seth Samuel, Judy Silber, Raisu Sussman, Stephen Short, Mary Wallace, and Melanie Young. Welcome back, Melanie. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And a shout out to City Car Share for providing an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You'll find them on the web at citycarshare.org.
Also, thanks to you. KALW is listener-supported radio. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll go deep into the canyon in search of participatory democracy.
It drew people who found life in Berkeley too confining.
A visit to Canyon, California tomorrow on Cross Currents. You're listening to power rocker Jay Traynor from San Francisco. He says he tries to bring back a sense of honesty to rock and roll in his recordings, but he's better known for his uninhibited freeform live shows. You can experience that for yourself on Friday when Traynor joins the band Felsen and others at the Brick and Mortar Music Hall in San Francisco. Music begins about 8 p.m. All of that information is at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
I see you moving. You show me to the door. Back to the night I